Mouse Audio Podcast Network. Part of the Boundless Audio Podcast Network.
Hello, history lovers, nerds, and feminists alike, and welcome to the show, Whining About Herstory, where your hosts Kelly and Emily are giving away fabulous prizes of obscure knowledge. Woo! Every listener today is going to walk away with information on two, count them, two women that they probably haven't heard of, but definitely should have. These women make great cocktail conversation and actually moments for when, you know, your sexist coworkers are shooting his mouth off about how women haven't done shit. So
you can be like, let me pull out this list.
Actually, if you just get your head out of your ass for 5 seconds, you will learn. But yeah, thank you so much for listening to Whining About Herstory. We're so excited to have you. I'm Emily.
I'm Kelly.
And that's it. We've been doing this long enough. If this is your first episode, welcome. If it's not, well, you know what you're signing up for. This is a choice you're making. It may not be a healthy choice, but it's your choice. I am not responsible for the poor choices that you're making. All right. Well, we are not drinking wine today. It's an early morning recording, and we're responsible adults who have other shit to do. So I'm jamming out to my gas station coffee. This big, beautiful 24-ounce behemoth only cost me $2.
Wow.
So I'm pretty jazzed.
I just finished my third cup of coffee, yep. So I'm going to be a little weird. But I'm drinking caffeinated water now.
Necesito más café.
Sí.
Más café. Café mucho. Which, by the way, Kelly is also learning Spanish.
Very slowly.
Well, it's a journey that we're all on for us to learn Spanish that everyone else gets to watch and be like, oh my God.
What nerds.
Brujas estúpido. Or estúpida. Fuck, see, I can't do it yet. But I love that you've been like sending me texts every now and then in Spanish. And I'm like, oh my God, I get to practice. And also, oh my God, I kind of know what you're saying without like looking it all up.
There were a few times I had to look up what you said because I'm like, I think I know what she's saying, but I want to double check.
Yeah. So I texted Kelly on my way. I was like, OMW, because I don't know what on my way in Espanol is. And I was like, necesito café mucho.
When you got here, you should have been like, está aquí. I'm here.
Oh, estoy aquí.
Yeah, estoy aquí.
Estoy aquí, I think.
Yes.
Yes. See.
Sí.
All right. Well, enough of our terrible Spanglish. Kelly, you are starting us off today.
I am.
We're diving right in. We are all business on this early cloudy morning.
At least it's not raining anymore right now.
Anymore. I mean, at the moment.
At the moment.
At this very moment, it's not raining. Although I was supposed to have a garage sale the other day, and I woke up at 7. Everything was wet because it had just stopped raining. And my dad texted me because he was going to bring some tables over for me to use. He's like, so what are you thinking? I'm like, you know what? Let me give it an hour. See what happens. Because we've had days where, you know, it rains in the early morning and then the rest of the day is just gorgeous. So I wake up an hour later and everything's still wet. It's cloudy. I'm checking the weather. It's supposed to rain again at like 10 and like sporadically through the day. I was like, you know what? I'm going to call it. This garage sale is DOA. We're not doing it. And as I send the text to my dad, I just suddenly hear the rain hitting my roof. And I'm like, thank you, Mother Nature, for confirming that I made the responsible choice. I really appreciate your acknowledgement and your affirmation.
Yes.
Yep. And I still went out and got caught in the rain like twice yesterday.
Yeah, it was hard to avoid.
Yeah. I mean, it was fun. It's just not good for a garage sale.
Yeah, no, not at all.
But yeah, Kelly, you are starting us off.
I am. I'm starting us off with Mary Tape.
Mary Tape?
Mary Tape.
Oh, I wonder what she invented. Perhaps some adhesive strip that is well known and loved by all of us. I wonder where that last name comes from. Also, the inventor of tape, was that just their last name?
I don't know.
Because tape has become it's a noun, it's a verb.
Yeah, and unlike Kleenex, it's not like a brand.
Yeah, it's because, you know, you got scotch tape, you got duct tape. It's just, yeah.
Anyways.
Well, this isn't about the inventor of tape. This is about Mary Tape, no relation.
Right. So Mary Tape was born in northern China near Shanghai in 1857. I looked everywhere and I couldn't find her original Chinese name.
Okay.
Could not find it. And literally, that is the extent of what we know about her life in China, is that she was born somewhere near Shanghai in 1857.
And she presumably survived her childhood.
She did. And yep. When she was 11, she immigrated alone to the United States.
Dude, remember when you can send kids in the mail?
Yeah.
I'm saying that as if either of us were alive when you could do that. But there was a period of time, at least in the United States, you could send your children in the mail. Mm-hmm. It really makes sending your child alone on an airplane to, like, go visit grandma and grandpa way more responsible. Safe, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So within 5 months of her arrival, she was taken in by San Francisco's predominantly white Ladies Protection and Relief Society. So this was a society established in 1853 in San Francisco, like I said, that pledged to, quote, render protection and relief to strangers, to sick and dependent women and children.
Wait, okay. Did they take her in like she went there with the intention of hooking up with them? Or she just, as an 11-year-old, peaced out of China, went to San Francisco, and then these ladies are just like, hey, where's your adult? And she's like, I have no adult. And they're like, oh, shit.
Except in Chinese.
What is this?
So this group basically, like, helped them find jobs and temporary housing. And it sounds like for a while she worked as, like, a janitor in a brothel. Yeah, it's like...
What a...
Real weird.
What a... you know, my first job was babysitting and teaching swim school. Her first job was cleaning jizz up in a brothel.
Yeah, right.
Because you know that's what being a janitor in a brothel is. Those clients are not clean gentlemen, okay? They do not care. They don't have their wife to nag them to clean up after themselves. That's why they're here.
So you know how I know we're talking loud?
Why?
Because my... husband just sent me a news article about people mailing children. And he said it wasn't as bad. It followed with, in addition, people who mailed their children weren't handing them over to strangers in rural areas. Many families knew their mailmen. If for some reason it's not loading the article, but I'm curious.
Okay, so. I'm just saying, just because you know your mailman doesn't mean you know your mailman, okay? I love it. This is the kind of support that we get, though. You know, the gentlemen in our lives are like, hey, you're talking about mailing children. Here's an article in real time about sending your kid via the post.
Yeah, it's kind of insane. So it says they found 7 instances of people mailing children between 1913 and 1915, beginning with a baby in Ohio.
Jesus Christ.
It wasn't super common to mail your children, but a lot of time for long distances, it was cheaper to buy stamps than to send a kid by the railway.
Do you like pin the stamps to their shirt?
I don't know.
Forehead? What? And does your local mail carrier take them the whole way? Because just because you know your mail carrier doesn't mean you know all of the other mail carriers along the way.
So this person, she's a 6-year-old. Jesus. They mailed her 73 miles to her grandparents' house. And she ended up on the railway anyways, because that's how the mail was delivered back then.
You've got to be fucking with
me. But they paid 53 cents in stamps, and then they just like stuck them to her coat.
Oh my God. Can you imagine getting that notification? Your grandchild has been shipped. Your grandchild will be delivered today between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m.
And then eventually, once the Postmaster General found out about it, he was like, no, you cannot accept humans as mail.
Oh my God. I love everyone's just doing this because they're like, yeah, I don't see the problem. You paid for the stamps. And then the Postmaster General is like, Why do I have to make this a rule? Why is this something I actually have to address?
Super common, okay. But it did happen.
That is hilarious. Okay, what happens if the child gets dropped off and there's no one home? Do they like stick the note to the door where they're like, could not deliver your child because no answer, aggressive dog, and then like you have to go pick up the kid at the distribution center. Right?
Yeah, I don't know.
They're staying in one of those like fabric rolly bins. Right. Okay, which one's yours?
How do we put them in the machine to stamp where they're going?
Where's Cheryl? Cheryl, which one of you is Cheryl? Brown hair, Cheryl. Sorry, there's no Cheryl here. You're going to have to go across town to the other distribution center. It's like, fuck you.
Oh, that's funny.
Oh, my God. You know what? I think it's super funny. Of all the things you can get delivered in the modern age, children is not one of them.
No,
I'm glad that as a society, we were all like, that's where we're
even
drawing
like animals,
the line.
Most people won't ship animals either. Like they do like car convoys because it's safer for the animal than like putting them in a box and shipping them.
Yeah. Although I've heard of people like, you know, who buy exotic pets like snakes and things like that.
Yeah. Reptiles tend to be a little different.
Yeah. But I don't know that. I kind of hate that.
Yeah. You too.
I'm like, oh, a living thing in the post. I already don't trust them with my regular deliveries.
Right.
Like, I've seen the way those Amazon boxes show up at my door.
Exactly.
Thank God that upholstery cleaner is not alive.
Fragile.
Yeah, it's like, thank God this upholstery cleaner isn't alive because this is a travesty.
Right. Okay, so back to Mary.
Now that we've cracked the secrets of mailing children in the post.
Apparently it was super cheap. Anyways.
Oh my God.
So they got Mary housing and jobs. And under their care, Mary learned English and American culture, and this is when she adopted the name Mary McGladdery after one of her caretakers. But like
okay.
I said, I literally every article I looked in, I could not find her Chinese name. So she did that for a while, was taken care of by them. In the early 1870s, she married another Chinese immigrant named Zhu Dip. He had immigrated here in 1864 and adopted the name Joseph Tape. So that's where it's Mary Tape.
Okay.
So he had a job as a domestic servant for a white family and then started delivering milk. And that's how they met, was because he delivered milk to one of the houses of the Ladies Protection and Relief Society that Mary was living in. Joseph would go on to own his own delivery service for Chinese merchants that would basically work from the docks to Chinatown. So, you know, they're getting things done.
Yep. They're living their lives. All about that hustle.
Right. So Mary and Joseph quickly learned to assimilate to American culture as it had like a big social and economic benefit, if you can do that.
Yes.
So they would quickly distance themselves from the community in Chinatown and they would begin a middle class life together in Cow Hollow, which I really hope still exists.
Cow Hollow. Love it.
Which is like a subsection of San Francisco, similar to Chinatown. They would go on to have four children. Mammy, Frank, Emily, and Gertrude.
They have such good taste in names.
Gertrude, I know.
You know what, Kelly? I'm not in the mood for your fucking sass right now. I do.
So as the family,
I'm gonna mail you to someone else.
as the family settled into their new lives, however, anti-Chinese discrimination was intensifying in the United States. Shortly after the birth of their children, Congress would pass the Chinese Exclusion Act,
mm-hmm.
which would ban Chinese workers from immigrating to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
It also prevented any Chinese people currently in America to become naturalized citizens.
Yep. I think we talked about that when
Bitch
I covered Mabel.
Stupid.
Yep. I think we talked about that like when I covered Mabel Pinghua Lee because she was a suffragist mm-hmm. and we don't know if she ever got the chance to vote because she was excluded from the 19th Amendment. And God, I don't think they overturned the Chinese Exclusion Act until like the 50s or later.
It was ridiculous.
Fucking nuts.
So obviously this act kind of intensified the discrimination and exclusion of Chinese immigrants, even though they were already facing that. This just really intensified.
Well, when you know, your country's government legislates discrimination, a lot of people get way more bold.
Oh, yeah. They're like, clearly this is endorsed.
Yeah.
So particularly in California, Chinese immigrants endured a lot of racist stereotypes, exclusion from like places and mob violence. They also faced a lot of legal restrictions on their civil rights, especially to marry and testify against white Americans.
Oh, fucking A. Yeah. Hey, you know how to create a culture of violence? Make one group totally immune from being held accountable for by
another group. Yeah, exactly.
Like, imagine a white person attacks a Chinese person. Oh, and that person survives. Oh, well, yeah, you can't testify. Matter. You can't tell us what that person did to you. So there's no
white person that can stand up for you. No,
yeah,
probably not.
That's fucking bullshit.
So besides just like the general racism, these anti-Chinese restrictions would soon hit a lot closer to home for the Tate family. In 1884, Mary and Joseph would try to enroll their oldest daughter, Mammy, who was, like I said, she was eight at the mm-hmm. time, in the Spring Valley Primary School, which was an all-white school near their home. But technically, there were no laws saying she couldn't go to school there.
It was this unspoken thing where it's like, we shouldn't have to tell you.
So there were, like, mission schools available for the Chinese children of San Francisco, but they were, like, a lot further away. And mm-hmm. so the Tapes were like, well, this one's in our neighborhood. Like, why can't our kids go there? Plus, they're like, if our kids go to an all-white school, it's going to make it a lot easier for our kids to assimilate.
Yes. Yeah.
So California did have a state law that said all children have the right to receive a public education. All children. However, members of the San Francisco school or board of supervisors, which is like the school board, they didn't want Chinese and Chinese American children to go to school with the white children.
Of course
we've
they didn't.
We've seen this before with other races.
Yeah, of course, because, you know, God forbid.
Yeah, right.
I don't know. I feel like I've gotten to the point where, like, this stuff is so, I'm just like,
it's just dumb. Yeah.
And I know this is, what, the 1800s or early?
1880.
Yeah, and I'm like, okay. I know that this was not uncommon for the time, but I'm still just like, God damn it. Can everyone just like grow the fuck up for 5 minutes?
Yeah, exactly.
This is just awful.
So the board maintained the incredibly racist belief that Chinese people could not assimilate.
Here's the other thing. Why should they have to?
Right.
Like that. I mean, first of all, anyone can adjust to a new culture and adopt a new, you know,
so,
but why is that so important?
But that was their argument, that they were like, Chinese people and Chinese people of Chinese descent can't assimilate. So they shouldn't be in our schools because they're not like us, which is
my
a dumb argument.
God.
So, they also, you know, there was also a fear behind it of if we let them into the white schools, they will assimilate. And they didn't want that either, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It was
crap.
Either way, it was
bullshit. It's going to be really hard to keep them subservient to us if they're getting the same education as our kids.
It's basically, exclusionists believe that assimilation was the first step toward establishing a permanent growing Chinese-American population in the United States, which would defeat the purpose of the exclusion policies. Anyways, so before Mammy could even set foot in the school, she was turned away because she was Chinese. Although she was born in the United States and was an American citizen, authorities at the school still viewed Mammy as a foreigner. Anti-Chinese, like I said, it was very sentiment was common, and they were viewed as racially inferior. And so Mary was like, no, this is bullshit. Like, my daughter deserves an education just like everyone else.
I did not schlep my way all the way here at 11 years old so that my child could not go to school. Kindly go fuck yourselves.
Right. So they said, so obviously they thought it was wrong that the Chinese and Chinese American children should be segregated. And they said, quote, the Tapes were the same as other Caucasians except for the features. Like,
yeah,
we're not any different. So Mary would argue that her family was just as American as their white neighbors because they had assimilated to the standards of the white middle class. The Tape children spoke English, had American-style names, and wore American-style clothes. Quote, my children don't dress like the other Chinese. They look just as funny, with a PH.
What?
I don't know. amongst them as the Chinese dress in Chinese look amongst you Caucasians. So I think it's supposed to be funny, but it was just spelled differently. Anyways.
Well, I think this is really interesting because it's like, no matter. Okay, I'm trying to think of a way to word this. This feels like a game, like the world's worst game, where you're trying to meet the standards of a predominantly European culture.
And then they just keep raising
and
the
bar. It doesn't matter how well you do, how much you assimilate, how perfectly you do everything, you still look Chinese. Therefore, it doesn't matter.
Yep.
And it's... Like I said before, they shouldn't have to assimilate. They shouldn't have to abandon their cultural heritage or anything like that. But that is the route that they have taken in order to succeed in this world. And I'm not going to fault them for that. No. This whole system is rigged and they're doing the best that they can. But even doing the best that they can, it's like, nope, because you're still of Chinese descent. Doesn't matter if you're a legit American citizen because you were born in this country. And I think that's a part of our history that we don't acknowledge that much, is how the U.S. government has specifically gone after American citizens. This isn't like an immigrant issue. It's, hey, no, I don't care if you were born here. You don't look European.
Exactly.
And it's like, you know, the people here first also didn't look European, right?
Right.
Y'all are immigrants, too. Y'all are descendants of immigrants.
Right. So on Mammy's behalf, Joseph Tape, because Mary couldn't, sued the San Francisco Board of Education. Andrew Jackson Mulder, who was the public school superintendent at the time, and Jenny Hurler, who was particularly the primary school, the school that they wanted to set as the principal of that school.
Yeah.
So he's suing three people. Well, an entity and two people, I guess.
Yes.
So on January 9th, 1885, the Superior Court of California ruled that excluding, quote, children of Chinese parents, end quote, from public schools violated state law and the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Because Chinese Americans supported public schools with their taxes, Chinese American children were entitled to a public education.
I love that. And you know, that's also a very, like, it's obviously like a very bureaucratic justification versus... Well, because y'all are being racist and that's bullshit. It's like, hey, their taxes are going towards these schools.
So
you cannot exclude them. Because I think that's also, I don't know, I feel like sometimes when you're combating racism like this, you almost need that really black and white bureaucratic reason for it. Because if the reasoning that, hey, we're all equal and we all deserve the same opportunities actually resonated with them, it would have worked by now. We wouldn't be here.
Exactly. So obviously the defendants are going to appeal the case because racism. So, and during this time, while Joseph and Mammy were the only ones named in the lawsuit, it was Mary that continued arguing their case in detailed letters of protest to the Board of Education, which concluded with an argument that prejudice is un-American. Quote, I will let the world see, sir, what justice there is when it is governed by the race prejudice of men. Just because she is of Chinese descent, just because she is descended from Chinese parents, I guess she is more of an American than a good many of you that is going to prevent her from being educated. So that was a little rough, but that was her writing.
Yeah. No, that's, I mean, she's absolutely right.
Yeah. So obviously because they appealed, it went to the California Supreme Court, who upheld the original decision.
Good.
That she could go to school.
Good.
So educators and administrators in San Francisco, however, remained determined to keep Mammy out of public school with white children.
Can you imagine devoting this much time and energy to telling an 8-year-old she can't go to your school?
Yeah, it's stupid.
Fucking A.
So as soon as they heard the decision from the Supreme Court, Superintendent Mulder telegrammed the California legislature, and state lawmakers quickly passed a law that established, quote, separate schools for children of Mongolian and Chinese descent, end quote.
Fucking A.
The board claimed that these schools provided a way for Chinese American children to receive a public education, albeit one still segregated from white students. Mary Tape refused to accept this and declared that she would never send her children to the segregated school. She would write to one of the local newspapers, quote, it seems no matter how a Chinese may live and dress, so long as you know they are Chinese, then they are hated as one. There is no rights and no justice for them.
I think what's interesting about this example is that because they have assimilated so much, it really highlights that this is not an issue of like a cultural difference or no. like, well,
it's
you know,
they look different.
They don't know the language or their culture. You know, it's like, no, it's because they, it's literally because they yep. look different.
So despite Mary's resistance, her children would end up attending the segregated school because she still wanted them to get an education.
Yeah.
So on April 13th, 1885, Mammy and her brother Frank became the first students at the new Chinese primary school in Chinatown. After several years, the Tapes would move to a more diverse neighborhood near the western part of Chinatown. Although they were still trying to distance themselves from the other people of Chinese descent, the Tapes also wanted to increase their children's marriage prospects, and they knew that interracial marriage between whites and Chinese people were strongly discouraged.
The rules of all of this
such bullshit
is really frustrating. It's because it's like, we want you to assimilate, but not so much that you actually integrate with us. Like, we want you to be American, but also subservient. It reminds me of the Indian schools where it's like, no. We want you to become as European as possible while still being under our thumbs.
Right.
We never want you to intermix or rise above us or right. even be on the same level.
So local newspapers that reported on the Tape v. Hurley case regularly remained interested in the Tape family for many years after the case. And although journalists would only refer to Mammy as that Chinese girl.
Oh, my God.
The press still made the Tape family well known, but in like a decent way. Like, Mary Tape gained a reputation for her skills as a landscape painter and amateur photographer. She also impressed a lot of white journalists with her ability to use a telegraph to send Morse codes, which she would send to her husband while he was at work. Mm-hmm. So like, she gained some popularity and got some like attention. She would die in her later years in 1935. And although she was ultimately unsuccessful in getting her children into white public schools, Tape v. Hurley was a landmark case addressing segregation in public schools. And it would lead to a lot of other landmark cases, such as Mendez v. Westminster in 1947, which ruled that school segregation of non-white minority children violated the Equal Protection Clause. And then that would lead to California Governor Earl Warren signing a law that ended school segregation in California. And then about 70 years after Tape v. Hurley was the U.S. Supreme Court case, Brown v. Board of Education, which finally ruled that all racial segregation in all of the United States in public schools was unconstitutional. So California was actually ahead of time on that one, but
yeah.
So yeah, that was Mary Tape and her struggle for her children.
You know what else I think is interesting? In the United States, we love a good rags to riches story. We love like the immigrant coming to the United States with $2 in their pocket, and now they're the founder of some
right.
multi-million dollar organization. And we even impose these rags to riches stories on people where it does not apply. Like Jeff Bezos, oh, he started Amazon in his garage. Yeah, his parents gave him like $300,000.
Right, like he's still rich.
Like, fucking stop. But here we have a woman who at 11 years old
just showed up in America,
schlepped her way to a different country with an entirely different culture by herself and made a life for herself and just fought tooth and nail for her children.
I really need to pee.
Why aren't we talking about this? Why aren't we talking about that Kelly needs to pee? We need to talk about this.
I know we do.
Okay, well, we're going to take a pee break.
Hey, guys. We know times have been tough lately for all of us.
And during hard times, it can be difficult if you don't have anyone to talk to, or it can be hard to talk about certain topics.
Being alone with your thoughts can be isolating. This is why we are sponsored by BetterHelp.
BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who are trained to listen to and help you.
Talk to your therapist in a private online environment at your convenience.
BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist. So you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. Thank goodness.
There's a broad range of expertise in BetterHelp's 20,000 plus therapist network that gives you access to the help that may not be available in your area.
You just fill out a questionnaire to help assess your specific needs, and then you get matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. That is Amazon fast. Then you schedule secure video and phone sessions. Plus, you can exchange unlimited messages, and everything you share is completely confidential, just like with an in-person therapist.
You can request a new therapist at any time at no additional charges. If you want to talk to someone about your mental health, you can get a 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/herstory. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/herstory. But yeah, no, I agree we need to talk about it. And like, I feel like it gets overshadowed by Black segregation.
It does.
African American segregation. And I'm not saying we shouldn't talk about that.
Yeah.
I'm just saying we need to know that it happened to other people. Honestly, America is just a bunch of xenophobes because it happened to the Irish people too. Like, it honestly didn't even matter the color of your skin. Like, it mattered more. But basically, if you weren't from America originally, they didn't like you.
Well, and I think that I'm really glad you shared this story because this is really some of those immigrant stories that we should be talking about because America, for better or for worse, we're a country of immigrants. The majority of us, our ancestors are not originally from here. They emigrated to the United States. You know, even if you were on the fucking Mayflower, you emigrated to the United States. And I think this is really one of the immigrant stories that we should be talking about because it really blows that whole American dream myth out of the water.
Oh, 100%.
It's like, oh, well, the American dream was only for some people. That whole showing up, stepping off the boat with $2 in your pocket and with hard work, you could make something of yourself. Here's the thing. Mary made something of herself for sure.
Oh, yeah.
But the country in which she tried to make something of herself
did not want her to.
They did everything that they could to knock her on her ass.
And to keep them down. Because
exactly.
They were like, no, we don't want your kids to get an education.
Generationally. Like this bullshit. Is a generational thing. Yeah. So tell me again that systemic racism isn't a thing. Please. I dare you.
Generational trauma or,
I fucking,
you know,
dare you. Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that story, even though it was a huge bummer. Mine's a little more fun, so.
Well, let's just dive right in.
Let's do it. So today I am whining about Dr. Joyce Brothers, the $64,000 woman.
Oh.
Bum, bum, bum.
In today's money?
No.
Back
then. Way, way back then. We're going to like the 1950s, the before times. The times of poodle skirts and, you know, everyone thought everyone
64
and like American idealism that was actually a fucking nightmare. Yeah, 64,000.
I'm just curious how much 64,000 to now is.
I think I have it in my notes later.
Okay.
So just
I'll leave my tab up.
Let it sit.
Let it settle, Kelly. Let it settle.
So game shows, like pretty much every other form of media, are meant to make as much money as possible. Mucho dinero. Es posible. Despite their outrageously expensive prices, the games do everything that they can to keep contestants from leaving with the top prize, if anything. I mean, because that's how you make your money. Oh, yeah. If you're giving away, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars multiple times per episode, you're going to be in a deficit. The numbers won't add up. Your accountants will get mad at you. But what happens when a game show conspires to take down one particular contestant? This is the story of Dr. Joyce Brothers, the $64,000 woman. Are you intrigued?
I actually really, really am.
So Joyce was born Joyce Bauer in Far Rockaway, Queens, New York, to Jewish parents, Morris and Estelle. I love the name Estelle.
I do too.
That's a name we need to bring back. Her parents were.
Call her Stella.
You could call her like Esty. I don't know, like Esty.
There's a lot of
cute.
Different yeah. choices.
You just call her Stelle. Like Estelle Esteller. So her parents were a straight up power couple. They were both attorneys with their own law practice. So they're like adorable. I love it. Joyce already has sister Elaine and her father Morris was banking on having a son next, even having chosen the name Joseph. But when Joyce was born, and, pivoted. You know, decidedly female. Morris decided that it didn't matter if Joyce was male or female, and Joyce grew up in an environment where gender didn't determine her future. She was expected to excel academically and pursue a career just like a boy would be expected to.
Good. Good for her family.
I know. I love that. So Joyce rose to these expectations, being described as someone who thrived on, quote, hard work and academic achievement. I almost said academic achievement.
Cheesement.
Emily does not thrive on academic achievement, if you didn't notice. It also helped that she reportedly had an eidetic memory, also known as a photographic memory.
I wish I had that.
From what I've heard...
It can be a pain in the ass.
Well, it's like... if you've experienced trauma, you exactly. never get the, you never really get that distance.
Right.
It's always like it just happened. And I'm very glad that I have That's some true. Distance from traumas I've experienced. So she graduated from Far Rockaway High School in 1944 and then enrolled in Cornell University with the Nard Dog, where she doubled.
Nard Dog?
Yeah, from The Office, Andy Bernard. Oh, He's right. always silent. I went to Cornell. You know, that was his nickname. That was a self-imposed nickname. So she double majored in home economics and psychology.
Yay!
My Kelly's face is going to light up, and I need to soak it in. She was also a member of the Sigma Delta Tau sorority, and I looked up the notable members.
Apparently she needs alcohol to speak properly.
I do. You know, I have this like neighborhood meeting presentation I have to give this week, and maybe I just need to do like 3 shots of Fireball beforehand. And just like, so thank you everyone. Like so much for you're all just such beautiful people. I fucking love you. Yep.
Maybe 1 shot of Fireball.
Like 1.5.
Okay.
Happy medium. Yeah. You know, it's all about moderation. But so I looked up the notable members, and most of them are actually in the entertainment industry as actors, Hollywood executives, or broadcaster. And the only person I recognized was Christy Carlson Romano, hey. Who was on Even Stevens and Voice Kim Possible. What's up, my 90s and aughts babies? I wonder what she's up to. I always liked her. I hope she's thriving. In 1947, she earned her Bachelor of Science and graduated with honors before going on to earn her Master's in Psychology from Columbia University, hoity-toity, in 1949. And she was awarded a fellowship by the American Association of University Women in 1952, which allowed her to earn her PhD in Psychology in 1953. So she is just doing it. Also, the American Association of University Women, my mom used to be a member. And I donated that to them for Christmas on behalf of my mom. And I still get cool stamps and swag from them.
Nice.
So it sounds like she's just killing it. However, getting into Columbia's PhD program wasn't without some drama. So not the drama. No. So is the drama.
Yeah.
Upon her acceptance into the program, her department dean confronted her. He admitted that she was more than qualified for the program, but... He's always a sexist little butt. Her presence meant that she was taking the spot of a man who could use the degree and encouraged her to drop out. Fuck you. Fuck you. Like, if there was a male candidate who was more qualified than her, great. But obviously there wasn't, so fuck off. Joyce was having none of it and completed the program. She's like, no. Not doing that. Joyce is basically our favorite person. Because her doctoral dissertation was called Anxiety Avoidance and Escape Behavior as Measured by Action Potential in Muscle. I feel seen. I feel like I would read that and be like, why is she talking about me so much? Because that's how my anxiety works. I'm just like, I'm just going to avoid everything.
Right.
So not only was Joyce slaying her way through college, she was also working as a research assistant at Columbia University and as an instructor at Hunter College. While completing her master's, Joyce married Milton Brothers, who was going to medical school and would later become a doctor of internal medicine. The couple would later have a daughter. Cute. Now, you'd think that marrying a doctor and having her own PhD would have the couple strolling down Easy Street, but that was not the case. In 1955, Milton was working as a medical intern at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York for the hefty sum of $50 a month. Oof.
A month. That's terrible.
Even in today's money, I don't think that was a lot. The couple were living in a New York City walk-up that Joyce described as, quote, slum-like conditions, and were struggling to support themselves and their now three-year-old daughter. And he's the only one making money right now. And actually, I get into this a little later. Joyce does have some, like, sexist views where she does feel that her husband should be the breadwinner. That doesn't mean she's not going to get involved in bettering her family's situation. So in an effort to help support the family through this financial hardship, Joyce decided to apply to be a contestant on the hit game show, The $64,000 Question. At the time, the popular show had the biggest jackpot of any quiz show. So with greater availability of television's game shows, flourished in the 1950s, and the $64,000 Question was one of the top dogs. It had the biggest jackpot of any other quiz show at the time, and allegedly President Dwight D. Eisenhower, ever heard of him, demanded not to be disturbed while watching it. My quiz show is on. World peace will have to wait.
Unplug that phone.
Yeah. Oh, the red phone is ringing? Fuck off. I'm watching the $64,000 Question. Do you know how much $64,000 is? It's $64,000. It's a fuck ton of money. Oh, someone's declaring war. Tell them.
Wait an hour.
Yeah. AFK watching quiz show.
Yeah, exactly.
It earned.
Do not disturb.
Yeah, do not disturb watching $64,000 Question. So it earned a number one rating spot for the 1955-56 season. It became the only show to knock I Love Lucy out of the number one spot at the time for like the Tuesday night slot, which is a big
prime time.
Yeah, this was a big fucking deal. So the $64,000 Question involved the host Howie Mandel asking contestants, which auto-corrected in my computer to contest ants.
Contest ants.
Oh my
That's
god.
Super funny.
Emily, what the fuck are you doing? Right
Training
now?
Contest ants. Clearly.
You know what? I would watch that show. Ants competing in like various intellectual and physical contests. Contest ants.
Contest.
The biggest little show you've ever seen.
Hey.
So the contest ants would have to choose a category. And the categories, I think they got to choose their own. I was kind of having a hard time understanding it, but I think contestants got to be like, I'm an expert in this area. And topics might, you know, include boxing, jazz, football, cooking, like that kind of thing. Then the contest ant would be asked questions based on that subject.
Are
and when
you
they
purposely saying contest
yes,
ant?
Okay. Yes, this is a thing. This is the way.
I just was making sure it was on purpose and you weren't just like, you know, subconsciously saying it.
I have an English degree and I say contest and. So they would be asked questions based on that subject. And when they answered a question correctly, they would earn starting at $64, which then doubled with each correct answer. So the tiers went from 64 to 120, 256, 512, and then to 1,000, 2,000, 4,000, 8,000, 16,000, 32,000, all the way up to 64,000. So there's like determinant tiers. It's not like you're going to be like, oh, I'm at $1,030. So once a contest ant reached the $512 level, they could retire and walk away with their winnings. However, answering a question incorrectly before this, they would lose all of their winnings.
Wow.
So you had to get to the like 512 level to walk away with pretty much anything. A wrong answer at any higher level would knock them back down to 512. So when a contestant reached the $4,000 Question, they would be invited back each week to answer one question and either advance with a correct answer or be awarded a consolation prize of a Cadillac.
So, Jesus.
Yeah.
So to like make it up to $64,000, how many weeks would that take?
So I think you can get up. Here's the thing. I probably should have watched an episode. Did not have time. Did not have the patience.
Yeah, but I mean, You have to watch a lot of episodes if she's only answering one question a week from $4,000 on.
No, and you're absolutely right, because I think maybe in one episode you can get up to $4,000 and then you come back each week.
Yeah. So that's what I'm saying. Like, how many episodes would that take to go from 4,000 to 64,000? Like, what is the jump?
It would be like
thing?
Four more weeks, because, you know, it goes, you know, you get to 4,000, then it's 8,000, 16, 32, and then 64.
Okay, that's not as bad then.
But still, that's like a month.
Yeah, of you going
of
in one
crap.
Day a week.
Yeah.
Answer one question.
So, if a contestant reached the $8,000 question, they would then be placed in the Revlon isolation booth. Because sponsorships were a thing back then, too. And this allowed the contestant to hear nothing but the host's words. And I don't know if this is supposed to be like a mind fuck or what. But here they would either lose or stay on until they won the $64,000. And if that sounds like it's difficult to walk away with much, then you're absolutely right. And that's the whole point. In fact, I can only find record of two people who walked away with the $64,000 grand prize. Yet Dr. Joyce Brothers was confident that she could do it, or more that she could do enough. She recalled, gee, a loser in one of those shows gets a Cadillac, and I could be a loser.
Right?
Like, man, even if you do poorly,
you get a Cadillac.
That's fucking sweet.
Right? I'd take a Cadillac.
But one does not simply walk into the $64,000 question. First, Joyce had to write a letter describing herself and what her hobbies were and why she'd be a good contestant, and then what she would do with her winnings. And all this information would kind of go into determining if she could be a competent contestant. Like, okay, are you going to get up there and like answer the first question wrong and it's super awful and no one cares? But also what kind of narrative that they could craft around her. Like, we see this day, we love these game shows where it's like someone... We want to root for someone who's working towards a dream or want to help their family, or, you know, because we can all get behind that. We can all identify with that. We all know what we would do if we suddenly had $64,000.
Fuck yeah.
You know, a lot of us would pay down student loans, mortgages, debt, which is kind of sad. It's not fun stuff. So Joyce earned an interview with the show's producer, Mert Copland. And part of the show's rules were that the contestants couldn't be quizzed on questions relating to their professional expertise, which meant psychology and home economics were out for Joyce. And Copland actually really liked the idea of having the feminine Joyce answering questions on masculine topics like sports, because comedy is all about, you know, defying expectations. And having a woman talk about masculine topics in the 1950s was like the ultimate comedic. So he said that she should be given a topic on, quote, something that she shouldn't know about. Something like if it were football or if it were horse racing or boxing. Well, Joyce's husband, Morris, was a huge fan of boxing, so she chose that as her topic. And ever the ambitious student, Joyce devoured years worth of Ring magazine issues, a 20-volume boxing encyclopedia set, and studied with boxing writer Nat Fleischer and former Olympic boxing champ Edward P.F. Egan. If you're into boxing, these names probably actually mean something to you, so you're welcome. Well, Joyce had an eidetic memory, which certainly helped in her studying. I don't want to undercut the insane amount of effort she put into her studying. Even if you have an eidetic memory, that means you have to actually read 20 volumes of boxing encyclopedias, years worth of Ring mag. You have to read everything. You can't just like flip through it and like recall it or touch it. And it's like, I know everything now. So Joyce worked her way up the ladder, answering every question correctly. And as she advanced, the questions became more difficult, focusing on like boxing referees and more obscure knowledge instead of boxers and things like about the actual sport. And then she was only given 30 seconds to answer. So they're trying really hard to, you know, make sure she's not walking away with much. Once she reached the $16,000 question and answered it correctly, host Howie Mandel replied, "You're right for $16,000. You knew the answers pretty well. What were you trying to do? Make me suffer?" I'm like this affects you in any way, shape, or form. You're getting paid.
Like, you don't give a shit.
Yeah. He then gave her some books to study for her return for the next phase of the show. Because they do that, like, they give you study materials.
That's
because
weird and interesting.
I think it's because the questions are supposed to be so difficult. They're like, okay, we're actually giving you some stuff to read. And when he gave her the books and told her to study, she quipped, "Study them. I can't carry them," because she's a fucking doll. Like she's like doing the thing. She's doing the TV personality thing. She's charming. People are rooting for her. And, you know, she's also trying to make,
"Oh, I'm just a petite little woman. I can't carry these heavy books."
Yeah, she's making a joke. Yeah. Which is just like, she's adorable. I love her. So audiences were enthralled with the charming Joyce, who was an expert on such a masculine topic. But not everyone was pleased with her success. Revlon, one of the show's key sponsors and makeup company? The Revlon. They fucking hated the fact that Joyce didn't wear makeup on camera because that's kind of their whole thing. And they're literally sponsoring the show. They have the Revlon isolation booth. And it looks really bad for them that a female contestant...
Wait, the Revlon what?
The Revlon isolation booth. I mentioned it earlier when you get to a certain level.
You said Revlon isolation booth. My mind was just like, all right. And then now that you're like, oh, they're a sponsor. I'm like, oh, that Revlon.
Yeah, yeah. No, Revlon wasn't just like a cool name for an isolation booth. It's the makeup Revlon. But they didn't like it because they thought it made them look like we're sponsoring the show and this bitch is even wearing makeup. And the male contestants don't wear makeup because they're men.
Right.
Men don't wear makeup. I mean, it's just kind of their whole thing. So to make Revlon happy, because we all know who holds the purse strings in these situations, the show purposely tried to make Joyce lose. And there was actually speculation that they even told her to take a dive. Oof. Joyce later recalled, quote, "They were going to knock me out with impossible questions, but they didn't. I'd memorized everything it is possible to know on the subject." She's like,
I love that.
She's like, "You can try.
You can try.
Motherfuckers. I studied. I'm like the ultimate nerd." So Joyce returned to the show the next week and won $32,000 before returning for a final week for a shot at the $64,000 question.
Please tell me you have the question that they asked her.
I do. I looked it up and the answer. So to call it a question, though, is not accurate in any way, shape, or form. It's actually a 7-part question.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Which means it's 7 fucking questions. I'm like, that's not fair. But at first I was going to give you the chance to try and answer these, but Kelly, I really don't think.
No. That is not my area of expertise.
There was one question on here that I was like, that's a cool piece of trivia. Everything else, I'm like, I don't know. So the first question was, what were the gloves of Roman gladiators in the Colosseum called?
Gauntlets?
No, cestus.
Jesus fucking Christ.
Yeah, yeah. Who was the first scientific boxer? I don't know what that is.
What was her broad topic of boxing. Knowledge?
Boxing. Yeah, but they got
gladiators,
even,
though?
Because it was their boxing. But it was their gloves, and they were getting as obscure and weird as possible. So who was the first scientific boxer, heavyweight champion of England in 1791?
No idea.
Daniel Mendoza. I've actually heard that name.
I
didn't know who it was, though. What was the name of the heavyweight champion of England who taught a famous poet the art of boxing?
No idea.
John Gentleman Jackson. And
John
Gentleman
Jackson.
He taught Lord Byron, apparently, which I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Who wrote the famous essay The Fight after having seen Bill Neat defeat Tom Hickman for the English heavyweight title in 1821? And what was Hickman's name? Or nickname, sorry. I was like, wait. It's like, Hickman. What color was George Washington's white horse? So it's William Hazlitt, and Hickman's nickname was Gaslight. Because he just went around, and he's like, hey. He like punch you. He's like, I didn't touch you. I'm not touching you. Like just gaslighting the opponent the whole time. I don't know. Question number 5. What was the full name of the Marquis of Queensbury who set up the Queensbury rules? I've heard of the Queensbury rules because that's like the gentlemanly whatever. The answer is John Sholto Douglas, the 9th Marquis of Queensbury. John Graham Chambers of the British Amateur Athletic Club actually wrote the rules. So, question number six. In 1933, Primo Carnera defended the world heavyweight title abroad. Who was his opponent, and where did they meet?
Some of these are multi-part questions.
I'm like,
which is bullshit.
This is actually like nine questions. Everyone go fuck yourself. The question is Paulino Uzukudan and Rome. They met in Rome.
Oh.
Finally, how many times did Jack Dempsey floor Louis Firpo in the famous fight in New York?
Four.
How long did the fight last?
No idea.
Within 30 seconds. So you get like a 30-second leeway in either direction. Nine knockdowns, and it lasted for 3 minutes and 57 seconds. So.
At some point, after like the third or fourth one, just don't get back up.
Yeah. Yeah, the concussions start having a negative return. There are diminishing returns on the head injuries you're receiving. So Dr. Joyce Brothers answered every damn question correctly, winning $64,000, which is over $700,000 today, and became the first woman ever to win and the second $64,000 winner in the history of the show.
Revlon had to be pissed. They're just like throwing down their lipstick like, God damn it.
Then I have this in my notes. Then she took some Revlon lipstick and smashed it on the ground.
Yes. Instead of a mic drop, lipstick drop.
Boom. My other joke was like, and then she painted war paint on herself with Revlon lipstick. It was like, come at me, Revlon. So the interesting thing is the first winner was a man and his topic was cooking. So is that similar? That's like, oh, you shouldn't know about this, even though cooking is a very basic life skill and important for survival. So Joyce was a sensation and her win opened her to a career in the media. She appeared on talk shows, was a color commenter for CBS during a boxing match between Carmen Basilio and Sugar Ray Robinson. And this actually made her the first woman boxing commentator, like ever. And she even had not one, but two of her own talk shows. The first was Living Easy with Dr. Joyce Brothers, which aired in 1973. And the second was the Dr. Joyce Brothers Show, which aired in 1985. And the Dr. Joyce Brothers Show premiered on the Disney Channel.
And what was it about?
It was a talk show.
On the Disney Channel?
Yes!
That seems weird.
So this was, okay, first of all, I didn't even know they had the Disney Channel in the 80s. Because I didn't get the Disney Channel until like the aughts. Because you had to like have some kind of premium. I don't know.
Yeah.
But this was her first. Okay. This doesn't make sense to me. But this was actually her first appearance on cable television. And she would have comedians, special guest stars, and answer viewer phone calls all about psychology. So it was just kind of like a big, you know,
it still seems weird for the Joyce Brothers show.
I know. A lot of this tried to be family friendly. So I think it was meant to be something that, you know, the parents and kids could sit down and watch and enjoy. Because now the Disney Channel is decidedly geared towards children. She tackled topics such as the psychology of football, HIV and AIDS, and school shootings. She was not pulling any punches.
Jesus.
She specifically addressed the 1999 Columbine school shooting and became an advocate for gun control legislation after the tragedy. She's like, hey, maybe we should make sure this doesn't happen again.
Right.
Wouldn't that be nice? Wouldn't that be just super, super great if this didn't happen again?
Yeah, it would be.
So having a successful cable show allowed Joyce to bring psychology into the mainstream and support destigmatizing mental health struggles. Throughout her career, she also addressed taboo topics such as homosexuality and being transgender. She also had cameo appearances on popular sitcoms such as Taxi, The Nanny, and one that I've seen 100 times and never like put it together, Frasier. Fucking Frasier.
Really?
Yes, it's in one of the earlier seasons. Frasier starts becoming a spokesperson for, he starts endorsing different products.
Yeah.
But because of his ethics, he's like, it has to be a product that I actually enjoy or would use. And he gets the opportunity to endorse these nuts. But he's like, ooh, I don't like those and I don't eat them because they're not good for you. So he passes on this like really big opportunity and is replaced with Dr. Joyce Brothers. And they show the commercial and it's this guy dressed up as a nut who says, "I'm a nut." And then another guy dressed up as a nut and says, "I'm a nut." And then there's a big nut in the middle and Dr. Joyce Brothers pops out of a nut and she goes, "You're both nuts. I know a good nut when I see one." Like, it does not age well. This was the 90s. Does not age well. She's like, "I'm Dr. Joyce Brothers and I love these fucking nuts." Like,
that's great.
And it was funny. I never bothered to look her up, but it seemed, it was one of those cameos where it's like, I feel like I should know who this is. Like, this must be someone who was notable at the time. And I just, it didn't click with me. So that made me really happy. Along with her television career, Joyce wrote a monthly column in Good Housekeeping for nearly 40 years and wrote several books, including What Every Woman Should Know About Men. And it was a very short book and it said nothing. No.
It said, hello.
It said, "Be yourself, bitch. You a bad bitch." Tragically, in 1989, her husband Milton died from bladder cancer. Aww. And this was probably the lowest point in Joyce's life, and she contemplated suicide. She went through it. To help cope, she really threw herself into her work and even worked to help others. And she wrote of her struggles in her 1991 book, Widowed. And there were several instances on her show where her experience with suicidal ideation and training as a psychologist helped her actually save lives. On an episode of her talk show, a man called in who was contemplating suicide because he was blind in one eye and losing sight in the other. And Joyce was able to keep him talking on the phone for 30 minutes until professional intervention was able to arrive at his home. And in a similar situation in 1971, a woman called in threatening suicide. And for 3 hours, Joyce kept the woman on the phone and was finally able to get her phone number and send an ambulance to her to help her. Which I'm like, oh my God, that would, like, that's just, that's wonderful. That's wonderful that help was able to arrive, but like, that would just be so stressful. Joyce was not without her issues though. Kind of, as I alluded to before, though she was a bad bitch who defied gender norms, there were still some that she held on to strongly. She believed that her husband should be the breadwinner. And on her show, when women asked what to do when their husband showed interest in other women, like either they were cheating or rubbernecking or whatever, she told them to look inward and try to be more like the women that their husbands were eyeing. Like, well, like, what is that woman doing that's drawing his attention? Maybe you could do that too. Which
isn't necessarily bad advice. But, like, I don't know. It's not. It's also not, like, great advice.
Here's the thing. I mean, there's trying to be there for your partner and fulfill their needs the way that they should try to fulfill yours. But if your husband is cheating on you, it's probably not because you're not set or you're doing something wrong. It's because they're a piece of shit. Same with women. If you know, your wife or girlfriend is cheating on you, they're a piece of, like, don't. Just, hold them accountable. It's not anything you did. So despite these cringy beliefs, she did advocate for women's rights and became more involved in second wave feminism in the 1950s, even providing proposals at a congressional hearing to address, quote, problems of midlife women, where she spoke about employment, anti-ageism, and retirement income. I kind of got the feeling, and maybe I might be making excuses, but that as like time progressed, especially second wave feminism kicked up, she got a little more liberal and was like, oh yeah, like women's equal rights and that kind of thing. Joyce's growing fame caused other psychologists and psychiatrists to become suspicious, and they described her brand as pop psychology, which we still hear about today. They didn't like that she was giving advice on television and felt she was more of a media personality than an actual psychologist, even though she did have a PhD. Members of the American Psychological Association tried to get Joyce's membership revoked, but they were never successful. It's not like Dr. Phil, where he's actually not a doctor anymore. She was a doctor the whole time. On May 13th in 2013, Dr. Joyce Brothers died in her home in Fort Lee, New Jersey, of respiratory failure at 85 years old. Legacy.
Yay.
Joyce received many honors and awards during her life, including the Women Achievement Award from the Federation of Jewish Women, Professional Woman of the Year from the Business and Professional Women's Club, and was given an honorary degree from Franklin Pierce College. Also, something else I'd like to, I kind of forgot to mention this, just because my notes got really long. The $64,000 question had a spinoff series called the $64,000 Challenge, where they took winners or like high performers on the $64,000 question and pitted them against each other on this challenge show. She won that too. And then also there is the great quiz show scandal of the 1950s, where it came out that the quiz shows were either helping people win or like making them lose based on who was more popular. And that was a huge thing. And Joyce did receive some scrutiny over that. They're like, oh, did she just win because the show made her? She's like, first of all, no. Second of all, the show actually tried to make me lose and I won anyway. So kindly go fuck yourself. So yeah, that is the story of Dr. Joyce Brothers, the $64,000 woman who told a game show in Revlon where to stick it.
I love that.
I just thought that was, I saw a post on social media where it had her name and it's like, oh, does anyone remember that time that a woman won, you know, won a game show and Revlon tried to make her lose because she wouldn't wear makeup on camera? And I was like, what? Like, I don't know, it's the ultimate, it's kind of the ultimate feminist story because she becomes an expert in a masculine topic, she won't wear makeup on camera, and they try to take her down for not adhering to those feminine standards, but they're also using those feminine standards to make it funny because they're trying to like, I'm trying to think of the word, subvert your expectations. Yeah, yep. Yeah, I don't know, I thought it was really interesting, and the fact that I saw her on Frasier, I was like, oh, I was so excited. I've probably seen her on The Nanny too, but I haven't been able to rewatch that because it's not on Hulu or anything yet.
Aww.
Yet. I love The Nanny. I love The Nanny so much. Well.
What do you think before?
Oh, shit.
Ha ha, I got it in first.
How dare you? I was thinking about The Nanny. You got me. So I am thankful that I got to spend some time with, my friend's daughter, Q. I've known her since she was still doing time on the inside.
That's a great way to say.
I taught her how to fist bump when she was a baby, cause I'm that auntie. And, so where her mom works, they're having like a family day fair and her mom had to work the fair. So she asked me if I could come and like take little Q around and like watch her and play with her and, you know, all this stuff. And it was so much fun. She gave me this big hug and kept introducing me to all of her friends. She's like, this is my friend, Emily. Oh, come here. I want to show you my friend. This is my friend, Emily. Like, she was so excited. And it was really nice to just be able to spend some time with her because I love her. And especially with COVID, I haven't had those opportunities as much to be Auntie Emily. So it was really nice. And I'm thankful that, you know, my friend would actually, like, ask me to do that and include me.
Aww. Yeah. And that Q was just so excited.
Oh my God. Yeah. She actually, earlier this week, I got a call from my friend and I was like, oh no, I hope everything's okay. And she's like, so Q wanted me to call you so she could say hi. Hi, Emily.
Oh, so that's, I was like, adorable.
I'm like, I'm not crying. You're crying. Oh my God. Yeah. But yeah, that was really nice. That's, I was very adorable. Happy for that. How about you? What are you thankful for?
I don't know. I guess I'm just thankful for the position I am in life right now. You know, like I have a lot of good opportunities and good friends and, you know, a roof over my head, and there's just been some things that have been making me think about it, and I'm really thankful for everything. I am thankful for everything and all the support from both like our patrons and you and my husband and everyone that listens. So yeah,
that was beautiful, Kelly. Everything is thankful. Everything is thankful for Kelly. Everything is thankful. I couldn't think of anything. It's the end of the show. I've exuded all of my creative / arrogantly obnoxious energy. Well, thank you so much for listening to another episode of Whining About Herstory. Like us on Facebook at Whining About Herstory, Instagram at WAHPod,
Twitter at WAH_pod. Our website is WhiningAboutHerstory.com, where you can find links to everywhere you can listen. You can find links to our merch. Actually, you're going to buy it right off the website.
Yeah.
And then we also have a Patreon where you can donate for as little as $1 to get some bonus content.
I actually wore my I Descent sweatshirt the other day. I got a lot of compliments. I was like, oh my God, that's so cool. I'm like, thanks. I designed it on Canva.
On Canva. Love Canva.
Oh, so much. Also, please raise 5 stars wherever you listen. It really helps. It gives us the warm fuzzies and it'll give you the warm fuzzies too. We love you.
We love you.
Thank you so much for listening to another episode of Whiny About Her Street. I'm Emily.
I'm Kelly.
And have an empowered day. Bye. I was trying to harmonize. It did not. Oh, shit. Kelly almost fell over in her chair.
Should we try that again?
Okay. Yes. Bye. I was trying to harmonize.